Welcome back to Tasteland. I am your co-host, Francis Zier.
And I'm Daisy Alioto.
And Daisy, who are we speaking to today?
Today we're talking to Andy Hunter. He's the founder and CEO of Bookshop. He's also the publisher of Literary Hub and the chairman and co-founder of Electric Lit. If you haven't used Bookshop before, Dirt exclusively uses Bookshop. It's an alternative to Amazon, and it aggregates the stock of indie bookstores around the world, basically. So if you want to buy from an indie bookstore, it's the best place to find the title that you're looking for.
If they don't have a website of their own, as Andy says himself in interviews.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But I think for some of them, even if they do. But we'll get into that.
I went into my Gmail to find my first bookshop.org purchase. It was in April 2021. And one of those books I've not opened. The other I did read. It was a two book order. We're talking Strunk and White's Elements of Style, which you know, in high school you read that, and I was like, I should get that. I should bone up on that.
Yeah,
I did not bone up. and then also Lauren Euler's Fake Accounts, which I did like.
I probably also bought that from Bookshop because it was like a COVID purchase.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I went nuts on there during lockdown. But for a while, like, the thing that was holding me back from shopping on Bookshop more was that I like to buy ebooks because I often realize I have time to read something at the last minute and need it immediately. But now they do have ebooks, which wasn't
as of the beginning of this year.
Yeah. So really, there's no excuse, guys.
Yeah. It seems like the last time Andy did many podcasts, he did a couple in February. Kind of around the release of their ebooks. It'll be interesting now that it's been most of a year to hear how that's been going. Anyways, while we wait for him, one thing I did last week was I went to the Press Publish NYC event in the Domino Sugar Refinery, towering, glittering above Williamsburg. This is Colin and Samir's. It's their first conference of this kind, but Colin Samir, if you don't know them, they're like the main, from YouTube, of YouTube media commentators is kind of how I would put them. They've been doing it for like 10 years or something. They started making the Cross videos, and now they're kind of like the premier like YouTuber talk show, I would say. It was cool. It was like, I think it was like 400 people there. There was some good speakers. Most of the programming I enjoyed. The best one was my favorite one at the beginning. It was this 20 years of YouTube history guy what is this guy's name?
While you're doing that, I was going to say, like, you and I are both going to a conference thrown by Air and our friend Ari, former guest of the pod, and he was listing off everyone coming to this thing. I was like, I hope there's a designated survivor.
Survivor
that's not that coming. Well, you know how, like, when you have executives from a company, you can't fly everyone on the same plane in case it crashes. Like, if this conference blows up, good luck, guys. There's not going to be any media left. Good luck finding stuff to look at.
The world could be so lucky. The world should be so
lucky. Yeah, okay. Well, okay, don't get any big ideas. V for Vendetta, F for Francis.
I didn't speak to him, but the guy who was speaking, Kevin Ioka, YouTube's head of culture and trends. This was a good presentation. It was one of those presentations that's just like really well dialed in and performed and good, almost call and response with like clips in the presentation. But he had some good data.
So not like Daisy Alioto's The Taste Economy presentation at FWB Fest 2024 that she didn't rehearse.
Well, you know, as a non-attendee of what, you know, those in the know call Fest, simply Fest, I can't really speak to the quality of your presentation.
I will say I got a meeting recently with somebody who was in the audience for that. Like, my friend was like, let me make an intro. And they were like, oh, you mean Daisy Alioto? I was at her talk in 2024, make the intro right now. So I was like, oh, thank God. My reputation precedes me.
Your reputation does precede you. Last thing I'll say about the conference, it was fun. But that venue, as you might expect for such a glittering glass dome in the sky, it's a little hot and the acoustics are a little weird.
Oh, man. Yeah. Was it just like greenhouse affecting you?
Only really like when you're in the sun.
Where you have like a glass wall.
Yeah.
I saw pictures. I was like, what is that? Because I think that only really reopened as a venue in the past couple of years, right?
Like in the past, like a year ago, even at most.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Reopened as a venue. Opened as a venue for the first time. For the longest time, wasn't it just an abandoned brick building?
Yeah, but I don't know if you were in New York, but there were like when it was shutting down or like going into the process of transitioning, there were like some art exhibits in there.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah. There was the
Kara Walker.
Yeah, right? There was the big Kara Walker, the Sugar Sphinx. Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, I meant like venue for like a Kara Walker, and now it's like a venue for YouTubers.
I love that Destroyer song.
Which one?
It's called like Ode to Kara Walker.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that. That's a great song.
Yeah, big Destroyer. It's Destroyer.
We haven't talked about Destroyer on this podcast.
Surprisingly. Surprisingly.
Yeah. I should go through a Destroyer phase. That's good fall music.
I'm definitely, have a specific memory. Last fall, I was biking to BAM to see Andre 3000 do his flute jazz thing, listening to Destroyer on the way. It's fall.
That's great. I was listening to some Big Thief. This morning.
You know, they don't do it for me. I've tried to listen. I don't know if I've ever listened to a full Big Thief song. Anyways, Andy's here. Let's talk to him.
One thing we talked about in the intro is how much I love Bookshop and shopping on Bookshop, but that I had been waiting for ebooks to be available there, which they have been since the top of the year, and that, you know, fully moved me over to shopping on Bookshop exclusively. But I'm curious, like, what the response has been like to that.
It's been really strong. I mean, it's really nice to see something that we work on for 2.5 years be validated. We're about like a year ahead of schedule. This year we're growing, we're going to be bigger than any other year. We're growing faster than any other year. We're growing like 65%, which is pretty incredible. In publishing industry itself is down like 3%. So I think a lot of people have like fully gone over now. I think there was always like a problem where somebody wanted to support local bookstores, but they wanted to read an ebook. They had to go to Amazon or wherever, and now they don't have to. And that makes a big difference.
And you fully attribute that growth to adding that feature?
No, it's not all that.
Yeah.
But we had all these technology improvements to our user experience, et cetera, that we bundled with it. So it's like we were fixing a lot of things and they all went live at once. But it's a big part of it. Like you can find more books. Like it doesn't have to be a book that we have in stock anymore. Like, the amount of people that find a book and check out is just much better now.
Fewer abandoned carts.
Exactly.
You said that the publishing industry is down, but you guys are up a lot. I think it was on The Verge, when you were on The Verge podcast at the beginning of the year, you said something about like with kind of political moments, you guys receive a sales bump when Trump won the election, around Trump's inauguration. There seemed to be a relation there. Do you think the political moment is partially to thank for your growth? I think on that same podcast, you were saying how like, you know, this makes people want to support small businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd say about a third of our growth is because of a political moment. You know, we have people like Robert Reich, who's doing podcasts right now, is always mentioning bookshop.org because he doesn't want to send people to Amazon because Bezos and everybody is like kissing Trump's ring. Mm-hmm. Well, that's just one example. There's just a ton of people who don't feel like rewarding big tech right now, especially because big tech has capitulated and cozied up to the administration. Even companies that you wouldn't expect, like Apple, even Bill Gates went to his summit. Like the only person who wasn't at his summit was Elon Musk because he's like been shit canned by the administration. But unfortunately, he hasn't been shit canned as much as I thought he was going to be. Mm. When he's like, Trump was on the Epstein list, I figured those government contracts would end, but they apparently are still happening. But in, you know, people are seeing this alignment between Silicon Valley and authoritarianism, and they don't like it. And I think before, what would have been the province of conspiracy theorists, like, you don't want to give up your data and you don't want to support the big tech because it can turn against you. Suddenly it feels more real. And the idea of like supporting your local bookstore at your corner that you go to every day and you know the people there is like, it becomes more vital because we're trying to preserve what we cherish in the real world, as opposed to like this kind of scary future where we lose control and we lose things like that. So I definitely think we are benefiting from that. And, you know, I just hope it doesn't go away. The problem with benefiting from political movements is that people succumb and they give up, like the, like how much resistance libs were there the second time Trump won. Like people just get fatigued, and places like Amazon have such a huge center of gravity that, that people just go back to old habits. So like our task is to keep that going, not just for Bookshop, but I think politically in general.
You said that publishing is down 3% on the year. How, where do those numbers come from? How are they quantified? Is that BookScan?
It's BookScan and the American Association of Publishers. And so the American Association of Publishers is all the big major publishers. It doesn't contain self-publishing quadrant. BookScan does contain self-publishing, but not everything that's sold through subscription services like Amazon's Kindle Unlimited. So there's like a lot of unknowns in publishing, but generally like the trade publishers like Penguin Random House, Hachette, et cetera, they're seeing slightly softer market.
And they self-report their numbers to the publishing association.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know if there are any like genres that you guys do better in than maybe the publishing industry more broadly?
Oh yeah, for sure. Our bestseller list is like nothing like Amazon's. We sell a lot of literary fiction. We sell a lot of political and like serious journalistic nonfiction. You know, we reflect the kind of books that sell well at indie bookstores. We are weaker when it comes to things like romance and YA, but we're making a move for the middle. Like we don't want to just be like literary fiction and political nonfiction. We actually want romance readers to support the local bookstores too. So we're trying to get all kinds of readers, but for right now we do skew also like, you know, East Coast, and West Coast, and more like college towns and educated, all that stuff. So we want to move towards the middle, but we're not quite there yet.
And when you, sorry, I was going to say, like, when you make those moves, like, how would you do that outreach? Do you run more targeted social media ads to people that are like, have a data trail of being a romance reader?
Yeah, we'll do that. We will, I mean, we were pretty careful about how we use our customer data.
Maybe they like, you know, if they like 831 stories on Instagram, you can use that as a proxy for their interest.
Yeah. And we launched a romance newsletter this week or last week. So now we have a dedicated newsletter for romance readers, things like that. And trying to engage the authors, do pre-order campaigns, just have good curation and good involvement in the community. Like with all these things, like you just want to be, feel like they're part of your world and you're part of their world. You don't. And so we want to hire people that actually love those books, you know, that can make good recommendations and talk about them online in an authentic way, all that kind of stuff.
How big is your team?
47 people.
Wow.
Wow.
Which is tiny. It's tiny for what kind of revenue we have. And, our whole entire operation runs at about 12% of our overall revenue, so all of our costs. And that's because we try to be as lean as possible because we are actually trying to give as much money as we can to bookstores. So, we're very, very scrappy.
The company is like about 6 years old now, right? How big was it? Like, when did you hit 10 people? When did you hit 20, 30? Like, what was the trajectory of the team growth?
Okay, well, 6 years ago, it was just me, and then it was me and David Rose, and then it was that, just two people for until 5 years ago, and then we had four people. And then when the pandemic hit, we suddenly had to hire, like, a ton of people. Mm-hmm. So because everybody started using Bookshop to support local bookstores that were closed during the pandemic. That was when we really grew from five people to about 30.
Oh, wow.
And then since then, we've been growing incrementally since.
Do you think if the pandemic hadn't happened, it would have been much harder for you guys?
For sure. I mean, I still like to think we would succeed. I mean, we're not in pandemic right now and we're succeeding. So I don't think that, like, some people suggested that a pandemic hadn't happened, like, we wouldn't have succeeded at all. And we were certainly worried about that because we had no money. Mm-hmm. You know, when we launched, we had about $200,000 in the bank, which isn't a lot to run a business that's going to try to take on Amazon. But I do think we would have succeeded anyway. We would have just had different kinds of stress. Like, instead of the stress of trying to support all the orders in the 1,200 bookstores that onboarded after COVID, we would have had the stress of, like, how can we make people pay attention to us? But that's what I've done before. I've had other businesses that succeeded where I'm like, nobody cares. So how do you make people care? So we've had both problems. Andy. Thanks.
Okay. Have you ever taken investment, and would you take investment today?
Yeah, well, I took investment, but only from individuals who really supported our cause. I have met with investors, I've talked to a lot, but the reason that we have hesitated to take investors from any kind of professional investment place is that they want a 10x or 100x return, which means there has to be an exit. And an exit usually means a sale, and a sale to a company that's going to keep our mission, it seems pretty unlikely. And you see all these companies like Grubhub, for example. Grubhub was a huge boon to local restaurants. They loved it. They were so happy to have Grubhub and the other kind of restaurant delivery services. And the fees are reasonable. Now the fees are like 30%. Restaurants feel trapped. They can't survive without them, but they kind of feel extorted by them because these services make themselves necessary. And then they extract more value from the market. And that's what an investor would try to do with Bookshop. And we don't want that to happen. So, you know, if somebody who was very, very aligned, like maybe like a really famous, wealthy author or something like that, was like, I want you guys to conquer the world. Here's $10 million. I would take it. But if, you know, a VC firm comes to us, like Andreessen Horowitz or whatever, and says, here's $10 million. I want you to conquer the world. I think we'd have to give up too much.
It's a business that can only take patronage, not really investment, as it
were. Yeah. Well, I mean, I do want the investors to, like, not lose their money and to feel like they got something out of it.
You would multiply it, but
yeah,
it might not be at a venture scale multiplier,
exactly. Which speed.
And a lot of that's unrealistic to begin with.
Yeah. For sure. And the pressure that comes along with it is just a huge distraction for what we're trying to do.
Yeah. You can kind of just ignore the pressure. If you control your board, if you don't control your board, you can't ignore the pressure, unfortunately. I was curious. So, and I don't remember the name of the company. So around maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago, one of the companies that was storing books for a lot of the self-publishing presses and small presses went under with
SPD.
SPD, yeah, right. So there's a question of, like, what is going to happen to everyone's inventory? And then also, like, how are we going to find a new place to store it? And then my impression was, like, Asterism stepped in to store a lot of those books and handle inventory for a lot of people. When I always go to Bookshop first to find a book, some of the books I've wanted have not been on Bookshop, but they have been on Asterism. I assume they're listed there because Asterism can store it and has its own site. Have you thought about becoming basically the storage and inventory provider as well?
Well, no, because I don't want to be a logistics company. Like, I don't have warehouses and warehouse staff and worry about that.
Yeah.
But I am going to onboard Asterism. So right now, the only Asterism books that we have are Asterism books that are either carried by Bookazine or Ingram, which are the two wholesalers that we're currently integrated with.
Yeah.
And so I just had a call with Asterism a week ago about getting them on board. So we're going to directly integrate with them. And that way we can sell all their books. And that's how we'll approach it.
I think that's a good move because I link to them in Dirt. And I'm like, I can't see if people are buying those books or get my little kickback.
No, I think it'll be great. And also it's like completely within our ethos to support independent authors, independent presses.
Yeah.
One question I had about these two things that have scaled over time. So I think if it was in this big Wired profile view from a couple of years ago or whatever it was, there was a couple quotes about a couple, I think it was a bookshop in Chicago that had received a lot of money through your profit sharing program. And I think the two ways the program works is there's, if you just buy from bookshop without selecting a local store, the local, it go, like 10% of the profit goes into a pool that's then shared across all the local stores participating. But if a local store sets up a storefront, they get 30% of the profit, correct?
Actually, they get 100% of the profit, but that's 30% of the cover price.
Okay, yes. So my question here is, like, was there an inflection point where a bunch of, so like early on, there's only a few bookstores, I know it's scaled pretty quickly, but a few bookstores participating. So they're getting, by default, a larger share of that 10% pool, right? And then as more join, maybe they're getting a smaller share of that pool because there's more in there. But of course, sales are increasing at the same time. How has it been like scaling these two different things? Have there been any inflection points where it was like you were almost worried where like the sales volume wasn't high enough to support the number of bookstores that had joined?
Oh, yeah. Or something like that? For sure. I mean, when we first, our first profit pool, which was July of 2020.
Because you do it every 6 months, right?
Yeah, every 6 months. And that's just like, I just made up these arbitrary rules because I'm like, how hard is it going to be? It's going to be really hard to do the profitable distribution. Well, let's only do it twice a year. But when we did our first one, we had grown so fast that there were a lot of bookstores who were like skeptical. They were like, what is Bookshop? Is it really going to be good for us? Is it going to be bad for us? Are they really who they say they are? And then we were able to give them all this huge chunk of cash and they were all really happy. And then suddenly even stores who had been kind of skeptical on Twitter DM me being like, wow, I did not expect it to be this much. And that was great. And then they, you know, that word spreads around. And suddenly by now we have 90% of the bookstores in the American Bookstore Association are members and they're all getting pool payments. So that did go down. At one point it went down to something like $780. That was like our low point. In 2023, when we weren't making as much money, we had stopped growing. And yeah, of course, that scared me. I mean, it scared me for a lot of reasons. Like the pool goes up when we're doing better. We had a ton of onboarding and we were splitting the same amount of money or a little less money among twice as many people. But now it's a different story because like our last July was actually more money than we've distributed than since 2020.
Wow.
In the middle of the pandemic. So like the solution is just to grow to support all those stores. And right now that's working. So hopefully it'll continue
if
that way.
You have 90% of bookstores on the platform. Obviously your first client is bookstores. So starting off, Bookshop's total addressable market was the number of bookstores in the United States. At a certain point, you will have onboarded everyone you could possibly onboard. And then, you know, does your focus turn to increasing the number of readers in the United States? Like at a certain point, something flips, right? And your client becomes the reader and increasing the number of people buying books in general, right?
Yeah, but it's, well, of course I want to do that. And I do think that bookstores and just discussion about books and everything that we do adds to, it keeps literature part of popular culture. And that's what I care about. Also for Lit Hub and Electric Lit, which I also do.
Of course, we should get into that too.
We got to like, books have to remain part of the dialogue and people have to be reminded of them and excited about them and talking about them online and to be at the tip of everyone's consciousness at all times. So in that sense, yeah, we want to keep people reading or make more readers. But short term, day to day, what I'm trying to do is get people to switch from Amazon to Bookshop. Mm-hmm. So like there's still 50 Amazon customers buying trade books for every one person that's decided to support local bookstores from buying on Bookshop or buying at their local bookstore online, if their bookstore has a website. So let's turn that from 1 in 50 to 1 in 10. And then we're really, that would just be completely transformative because that would be a 5 times increase. And I think it's really possible, especially with these political moment. And we know that only like the last time we did a survey of book readers, which was 2 years ago, only 30% of people had heard of Bookshop. So now I think it's probably more like 40-45%. But still, that's like a lot of people that just by getting them to hear about us will get us halfway to where we want to be. So yeah, it's about getting people to leave Amazon, support their local bookstores with their book purchases. That's the main drive now that we've onboarded all the stores, just kind of going after the big one.
Which tactics have worked best historically to move people over? Because in my experience, and this is a little bit different, but you know, I have to think about messaging. How do you get somebody to pay for a subscription? In this case, like the book isn't going to cost more with you, but maybe they think that there's going to be some sort of time or convenience cost, which I think for a lot of people, once they have achieved a certain amount of financial comfort, all of the decisions become about friction, not about the difference between $10 and $12. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I found with subscriptions, or I believe with subscriptions, shaming does not work. Like shame-based messaging doesn't work. But obviously, like if people are reacting to the political moment, there is some sort of like value alignment that you could appeal to. I'm just curious, like from a messaging perspective, or just from a like perspective of like how you're reaching people, whether it's ads or newsletters, like what works best to move people over?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing is like just peer endorsement, word of mouth. Like that's what is most effective. And that's kind of like peer pressure. And that can also be an author like John Green saying like, hey, use Bookshop, or Robert Reich saying, hey, use Bookshop. That makes a big, big difference. Mm. And we just try to encourage that. Obviously, we can't completely control it, but we can try to encourage authors and agents of authors and publishers to say, like, please say something. And most of them don't. Like, most of them don't because they want to have, like, the high Amazon ranking, which sucks. But the ones that do make a big difference. In terms of messaging, I don't know if it's quite shaming, but we do effectively say like Amazon doesn't want your money, or support booksellers, not billionaires. Like that does work. And on social media, like on Facebook, saying like break up with Amazon gets a lot of engagement. Sometimes the people are mad. Like they're like, you know, I use Amazon for blah, 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 or I like Amazon. But it creates a lot of engagement because it's more controversial than a message like support your local businesses, which is like the positive version of
it. It's good to have an enemy.
Yeah. And so, and the increased engagement increases visibility, as we all know, like that's what the whole media sphere is doing right now, and encouraging radical opinions and stirring people up. So that does work, but we do try to make it like, we don't say like people who shop on Amazon are bad, stop being bad. So there's not like shaming. But we do say like stand up to the billionaires and support local businesses.
You say vote with your dollar. You don't say you're bad because you vote this way.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Have you been impacted by tariffs at all?
Not too much. We will be if we create an e-reader, which I want to. And we're in the planning stages of creating our own like the anti-Kindle.
What's on your hardware wish list for this? Because we had Reggie James on the podcast, and he put out a book called like Hardware 2024, which was like a snapshot of teenage engineering.
Daylight,
which was they don't use e-ink. E-ink is technically like a proprietary term. Yeah. E-ink adjacent thing, tablet. So I've talked to the CEO of that company, and he was in Dirt and then included in this hardware book. Like, Dirt has been really interested in the hardware renaissance, and I pay more attention to hardware than I ever have in the past. So obviously, like, you know, Kindle, you know, there's a value misalignment with parent company. So, you know, it's enough to put out a competitor, but like, how would you improve on it from a hardware experience perspective?
Well, first of all, just kind of using the best possible technology. So we're planning to use stuff that's not even out yet. So making sure that when it comes out, it's like the best e-reader on the market.
Is it going to look cool, Andy? Is it going to look cool?
It'll look kind of cool. I mean, it's still an e-reader.
Yeah.
And I don't want to pay like an industrial designer $100,000 to do it. If there is an industrial designer that wants to work for $5,000, they can call me up. Mm-hmm. But, so we're very DIY. But it will have a great, very responsive, very fast full color screen.
And you're funding this out of Bookshop profits. You're funding.
Well, we don't really have enough Bookshop profits, but the ebook thing is going well. So yeah, we will have some. And then I'm probably going to do a Kickstarter.
Mm, and that makes sense.
When I do the Kickstarter, that will also be a judge of how much people want this. And if people want it, the Kickstarter will do well. That'll help fund it. I might have to ask investors for money. I'm not sure. It just kind of depends. We could afford to buy, you know, 20,000 of them without going bankrupt. But I want to sell 50,000 or 100,000. And so we might have to raise money for it.
Are you enjoying that design process? I kind of got shivers when you told me that, because I was like, dang, that must be so cool.
Yeah, I definitely love it. I want it. Like, I'm not sure I can do everything I want, but I should be running the most recent version of Android that any Ink device can have. I want to have the ability for a user to decide if they want to unlock it or not. So right now, people are like on Reddit jailbreaking their Ink devices so that they can just download whatever Android app store thing. And hardware sellers don't really like that, because then it can create all these problems. So then your customer service ends up answering questions for people who have jailbroken their device and screwed things up. But I want people to just have the option. I want them to have the flexibility to either like have a pristine thing that works great, or jailbreak it and do whatever they want with it. The pages will turn like 35% faster without the kind of flicker. It'll look great. It'll support audio too. So if you want your ebooks read to you, or if you want to listen to audiobooks on it, it'll have Bluetooth, all that stuff.
I'm like, when I say I bought something for my Kindle, what I really mean is I'm using the Kindle app on my iPad that I only use to read on. So I'm like, yeah, kind of like, I'm doing like the unoptimized version of everything. I also am fascinated, and I don't know if you know more about what happened here, but when Kindle switched over to Kindle Classic, but in such a way that they couldn't just like update the software, and now there's two apps, Kindle and Kindle Classic, that blew my mind, because I was like, I now have two things on my device, Kindle and Kindle Classic. And it reminded me of like, you know, I'm sure that they had a good reason for that, but it just seemed like so kind of like not something that should be happening in contemporary times. It was very like with cryptocurrency, where they had to like fork off a cryptocurrency, yeah, and then you end up with like ETH and ETH Classic.
I've never heard of Kindle Classic until this moment. That's how good a job I've done it.
Well, go down the rabbit hole with me, because I thought that was very bizarre.
is there like an app, like a native iPhone e-reader?
Well, there is Apple Books.
Oh, that's what I'm thinking, because I've only ever read one ebook, and I think it was using that, not the Kindle app or anything. It was The Motion of Light and Water by Samuel Delaney. I had to read it in a college class, and no bookstore around me had it, and I had neglected to buy it, which is all just to say, yeah, I have no experience with ebooks.
Here's another funny thing about a Kindle. I don't know how you would address this with your e-reader, Andy. When I get galleys, I ask for a PDF, and then I email it to my Kindle. And then my Kindle is like, is this really you? And I have to verify. Yeah. But I have for a long time thought it would be really cool to figure out other people's Kindle email addresses, so that I can send them things, maybe books, maybe messages. Can't be that hard, but I think fortunately, I'm not getting those spam job texts to my Kindle yet, but I feel like the time is coming, because like my Kindle address is not that hard to figure out.
Even worse, you could get spam AI novel galleys.
Well, yeah. I would like to get a spam AI novel romance galley about two people that met and fell in love in a group job spam text thread, because sometimes if they hit me in the right mood, I'm like, I'm gonna start some jokes in here and see who stays.
Andy, I want to ask a question about used books. So you guys don't sell used books, right? Secondhand books. I buy a lot of secondhand books online, usually from thrift books. For a long time I was buying from Abe Books. I didn't know they were owned by Amazon, sometimes on eBay. But thrift books is the one major one, right, that's still independent.
Do you I just found out just now from you that 8 Books is owned by Amazon. That really? Is oh. Very sneaky. Mm-hmm.
They don't brand yeah. it.
Dishonest Abe.
Yeah, it's one of the worst things. It's one of the annoying things is that when people on the internet are like, what are Amazon alternatives? And there's always somebody in there who says, use 8 Books. They're great.
Wow, Andy, are you a keyboard warrior? Do you get in Reddit and debunk that?
No. Although there is a thread on Reddit about whether bookshop.org is the next Amazon, which I've been very tempted to dive into.
No,
I'll do it. I have some burners.
I did find, when I was preparing for this yesterday too, I did find mostly from 2023, a few articles saying, you know, Bookshop isn't what they say they are, isn't as good as they are, which I think
that was in 2020. That's the New Statesman.
Oh, well, there was some substacks and stuff, yeah. I found from 2023. Yeah. But I mean, the clear argument there is like, and you said this, I think, I'm going to paraphrase you, that the number one thing to do is go to your local bookstore in person, buy a book. Number two, if they have a website, go buy it. Number three, buy it on Bookshop, because otherwise people are just going to buy it on Amazon. So it's like, you're not taking sales from local bookshops. You're an option that stops people from buying from Amazon, which I think to me was so obvious. And it's like reading that now, I was thinking of just kind of general like AI skepticism and such, in that sometimes it seems like people refuse to acknowledge that, oh, these things are happening and are being implemented. And like, yes, you can refuse to use them at all, but like, it's best to I'm losing the plane here a little bit.
A lot of people think they hate business when they actually hate capitalism.
Yeah.
And I have had to leave those people behind.
It's that classic joke, how can you critique society when you live in it or whatever?
Yeah, exactly. And there's a lot of play in just like, oh, this thing that everybody says is great, it's actually terrible. Like, that's a great way to get clicks and
yes, it is.
And engagement online.
Those articles certainly ranked in the SEO. So
yeah. So, but 90% of bookstores are on the platform now. Like when we go to bookseller conferences now, they're so happy. Their sales on their websites are up 300% since when we launched, because our message is always like, support local bookstores, support local bookstores. Mm-hmm. Altogether, independent bookstores are selling 6 times as many books online right now than they did before we launched.
Whoa.
And that's on their websites and on Bookshop. Mm-hmm. As a whole, like, there's so much momentum that we're driving that even the people who were really skeptical, I haven't heard anything from them in 2 years.
A paid from the haters. That's right.
I hope that they want to hear this podcast and be like, I've been neglecting my hater duties. I've got to get back online. But yeah, it's been a couple of years since I heard any critiques like that.
Andy, question. Are you having to think about now, obviously you want to show up in SEO above Amazon when people are looking for books. And I've known from talking to you in the past that you guys have spent some on Google to do that. Like, now you have to think about being visible in these LLMs when somebody asks ChatGPT, what should I read? You want them to send people to Bookshop. How are you navigating that?
Yeah, well, we've had some calls with consultants. I've just been doing reading. It's not a major market force yet. And it'll be really interesting to see if ChatGPT does add a shopping cart, which is something, you know, they have hired a product person who says that they want to have a shopping cart, in which case it would be really essential to be present there and allow people to buy through it. I think that a lot of what the LLMs are doing things like scraping Google and scraping conversations. And I think we'll do pretty well in that sense. Like, the advice I've read is like, be mentioned on Reddit and all that stuff. Well, that's already happening with us. Like, we have the real version of what people are trying to gain. So hopefully we'll be okay, but we do, like, it is really, really serious, because it's already 10% of all search engine queries have moved over. And Google's AI summaries are also killing traffic to websites everywhere. So being on top of it is really important, but we're not actually like spending money on it yet, because it's changing so much and there's not that much we can do right now. We already try to foster conversation about us online, which is what all the LLMs are scraping.
It would be a pretty genius PR move by the OpenAI team to make sure that all mentions of books are Bookshop links. I think it would be a good rebuke against
mouth to Tim Alton's ears.
Exactly. Good rebuke against AI-generated books flooding the market and such.
Absolutely.
Have you thought about using AI? I mean, I'm sure you already have some internal algorithms to the Bookshop platform, but refining your ability to recommend people's next read through the platform.
I mean, yeah, but I don't think, like, I think our consumer is somebody that probably is AI skeptical or AI hostile, and like, booksellers don't want computers giving bookseller recommendations. Like right now, yeah, we have all human book recommendations. Everything is recommended by people. If there's a way that we can match people better using AI to a human recommendation, that's cool. But we don't want an AI doing the recommendation itself.
Mm-hmm. You want to replicate the employee picks shelf.
Yeah.
The bookstore.
But if we can find the right employee for you through AI, we could do that. But that's more of a connecting thing than writing.
But if I check out and it's like more books like these that you might like, that's not 100% human.
No, but it has
that's
to do
more with, like, tagging, right?
Yeah, it's tagging and sales and popularity. Mm-hmm. But all the book lists are humans, and things like shelf talkers and our emails and stuff like that are all
I have experimented with. I keep a list of every book that I've read, and I've experimented with feeding into ChatGPT to see like what it tells me to read next.
Have you listened?
I don't think so. I'm trying to remember. I think it did tell me to read Perfection, but at that point, like five people I know had recommended it to me. So it's not like it ranked that highly.
I mean, my fear about that is that it'll be like when Madeline McIntosh was interviewed in the New York Times a few years ago when she was still the head of Penguin Random House. And she was talking about Amazon and bestsellers. And she said, bestsellers are bestsellers because they're bestsellers. In other words, like the books become bestsellers because they're bestsellers, and then they're recommended to more people. Yeah. And so Where the Crawdads Sing ends up being like the number one book
prophecy.
For 3 years. AI is looking at like who's talking about these books the most and what are the books that are most talked about by people with your interests. And so the great thing about a bookstore employee who's a curator who cares about putting the right book in your hands is like, they might unearth something that nobody's ever heard of. AI is never going to do that because it's all going to be looking at what are the most recommended books. And so then you're going to have a more of a narrowing of the book market, less diversity, and more of like this kind of blockbuster phenomenon that's already taken over the book market, where the mid list has been hollowed out and like either a book is huge or it sells fewer than 1,000 copies. I don't want to reinforce those mechanisms. I want to figure out other ways to get around them. But AI might have a place in that. But in general, I feel like people who are shopping at Bookshop are probably the same people who don't love AI because they're creatives. They're people that value human contact and human society. And so they're not too excited about these AI changes.
Well, if you followed my trajectory with ChatGPT on this podcast, I'm very bothered by the low EQ of the ChatGPT interface, which is, I realize, I'm not talking anything, but the interface itself, very low EQ. It's useless for so many things. But during the times when I've been able to get it to do a bullshit job, David Graeber style for me, that hits like the best drug. But it's so, you have to be in such a specific position where like, the other person is not expecting much of an output from you, and you're not expecting much of an output from yourself, which is like kind of the definition of busy work. And I've really tried to optimize my life to never be in a position where the person I'm talking to doesn't expect my best work and I don't expect my best work of myself. Every once in a while that does happen though. And I will say like, it's lovely to not have to use my brain for that, but I would like my brain to be like flexible and, effective for a long time. So I don't know. I think it's going to create more busy work. I saw a tweet today that was like part of the problem in hiring right now, downstream of what's actually happening with the economy, is you have people sending in AI generated cover letters and resumes being read and filtered by AI.
Yeah.
So and robots talking to robots.
In schools too. And it happens in marketing emails and people really like, they use AI to generate emails and then they use AI to summarize it into a few bullet points. But like, there is that concern that people are like offloading their thinking and going to get stupider. And that might happen. But in your case, I think what you're talking about is taking stuff that is actually quite mundane and onerous and hopefully will free you up to like use your brain in other things. Because when you're doing this kind of low stakes work, you're not really exercising your brain too much in the first place. I guess where I fall with AI, sometimes I feel like oh, this actually is going to like ruin humanity. Whereas my whole life, I've been more of like a technology isn't so bad. Like we're going to use technology to support the culture and values that we have. So like use technology. I mean, to
you've always worked in both, right?
Yeah. Literature. And then I'm like, well, maybe AI is like the technology, like the end game technology that is going to really not be good for people. But then I also feel like human beings are very adaptable, and that in a way, like we act like organisms that have to take a moment to form antibodies and reject or adapt to a change in our environment. And we just haven't made those adaptations yet to cell phones or AI or all these things that currently seem destructive, like adolescents having spiking anxiety and all this stuff, or like AI ruining education. I feel like it's just the moment that like a virus takes over your body before your body has time to respond. And in a few years, unless we have like a civilizational collapse because of super intelligence, we'll adapt and AI will find a place and it'll probably be okay. Probably. But I'm still more AI skeptic than I have been like skeptical of the internet.
I feel like millennials have been forced to be like a generational antibody buffer.
Yeah.
Between like a generation that, well, not Gen X. I think Gen X knows how to use the internet, but like people who don't know how to use the internet and people who only know how to use the internet are sort of like in the middle as sort of like this very thin barrier. And I don't think it's going well for us. I heard we're like a lot of us are dying early. I think it's a death of despair. Not me. I'm planning to stick around, but I'm not happy about it.
I think it's more like there was a golden age where people didn't have to die of despair. For most of human history, we are all dying of despair, and now we're just going back to the norm. Mm-hmm.
You're so right. It's a reversion to the mean.
One thing you said in that same Wired profile from a couple of years ago, near the end, you know, when this kind of lofty vision near the end type of statements, it said that you maybe someday want to take the bookshop model beyond bookstores, hardware stores, toy stores, and I'm going to quote the article here, to be another everything store of sorts, but one built around preserving small businesses instead of competing with them. Is that something you still think about, or are you so just in the bookshop problem right now and that's so far down the road?
I think about it all the time. I try to make sure that when we build new things, we're building them in such a way that they would be flexible and adaptable. I feel like bookshop, we need to do more. We need to have more functionality before we could be toy shop. But yes, I still want to be toy shop, and I want to help arts and crafts stores, and I want to help bike stores and beauty shops and everybody that is being squeezed by, well, like Walmart, Amazon, this huge e-commerce marketplace growing that do home delivery that end up potentially hollowing out our downtowns and, you know, the importance of civic spaces and where people can meet is just so critical. Like, yeah, we should defend that, and we should build structures that help those compete with these giant e-commerce monopolies for sure. And if bookshop could do that, like that would be my ultimate, like I would die happy. Yeah. If that happened, if there was like, we stopped all these towns from being hollowed out and downtowns from like being vacant storefronts, etc. We're a long way from there, but not that long. I'd say like within 6 years, I hope to be there. Yeah. Where we have this product that is supporting all these different industries.
And you don't want to touch logistics. So, but what about like, I mean, I always joke Amazon's actually a storage company because AWS is the big product. So what is your AWS?
Well, it would be sort of like if you have an iPad and you want to run a small business, like you can do POS, you can do a website, you can do everything you want. And it's really easy. It's kind of like Shopify, but more than Shopify, also because there's this umbrella that makes it really easy for a consumer to find you and support you. And this kind of a collective support as well as individual stores. But like where like the logistics thing, if we could have warehouses full of books and ship to people, like that would be wonderful. But it's kind of that would be like $100 million.
Yeah.
And I could potentially raise that. Like right now we're growing so fast that like we're growing as fast as companies that are getting valuations of $1 billion from Silicon Valley. I don't think I fit the profile. I honestly, no VC, I think, even wants to invest with me once they hear me talking like 20 minutes. But
we'll know after this podcast, for sure.
If we did take $100 million, then they're gonna want us to turn into Amazon, and that's gonna screw everything up. So it's better to work with wholesalers. There's wholesalers in the toy industry. There's wholesalers in the book industry. More and more wholesalers have the ability to ship directly to consumers. So we are a layer. Even like Kylie Cosmetics or whatever, like they're all these Instagram businesses, they're not owning their warehouses either. Like they're subcontracting.
Celebrity wrapped drop shipping.
Yeah. There's a world in which what you're doing and like expanding this model to other industries is like something the government should be doing, should have done as like a public institution guarding against, as you're saying, you know, the gutting of small towns, right? Like, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, but there's like maybe a sci-fi world in which this was like the government's answer to tech companies gutting small
businesses. In a perfect world, people like Andy would be getting public goods funding, but
that's what I mean, really.
Yeah, or like the SBA could at least talk to me, like reach out to me. Like nobody ever, like there's even in Brook, there's like startup, there's like fostering startups in New York, like Build NYC. Like I'm a Brooklyn-based business, we're like changing a whole industry, or we're doing really well, but nobody talks to me. Like nobody has ever reached out from any government agency whatsoever. And I don't even think their policies are particularly friendly.
No.
Like at the very least, you don't want to be hostile to small business. And even that isn't really true. So
being ignored is sometimes the highest signal of success, Andy, I found in my experience. It's actually interesting. So we had Sarah Leonard from Lux Magazine on the podcast, and she was telling us that they actually had to build their own fulfillment system software because nothing else was working for them. And me being like, you know, having business brain, I was like, oh, you should license that to other magazines.
Yeah.
But like, they should license that to other magazines. So it's like when you're building things that are useful for yourself too, you have to assume it'd be useful to other people. Mm-hmm. And like Andy, Francis, I don't know that you know this, Andy and I had coffee and I was telling him about Clam before I even wrote my essay, sort of talking about my philosophy of micropayments and AI. And you were very receptive to at least listening to me, because I think you and I kind of think about things in the same way.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you asked about used books earlier. Mm-hmm. We do sometimes sell used books if we're completely out of stock of something. Mm-hmm. We partner with a company called Biblio. But my hesitation with used books has always been like, I want authors to be paid.
Yeah.
I don't want to sell a used book for like a new book, like, then it's $26 and then there's a used version for $8. And then the publisher, who's probably our partner, and the author, who might be my friend, doesn't get paid. So I don't love that, but
it's a great problem with
the one thing that I like about blockchain is that it does kind of have a potential to allow micropayments for things like the sale of used books. Like I really believe, like, I believe artists should get a cut of the resale at auction. I believe that authors, if somebody's making money off of the sale of a used book, like the author should get even a penny would add up, you know? So I'm not like, blockchain is like AI. It's like the kind of thing that some people have like an instinctual, like get away from me reaction towards, because what if the NFT like and crypto scammers and froth, but I think that there is a place for it. And like micropayments, I really like that idea. I think the idea of creators being integrated in micropayments and being able to get paid like wherever their digital goods are sold is, or even physical goods eventually, is a good thing. And that's why I'm excited about it.
What about like rare books? I've seen some articles about millennials and younger people getting into antiquarian stuff. I think the valuing of the uniqueness of a physical good that just can't be replicated feels like the opposite of digital slop. And I know, like, I agree that there's used books in a sense undercut the primary market for contemporary books. But what about like a sort of $300 first edition of something that somebody wants to give as a gift?
Yeah. I mean, I think, well, I would say I'm not even shaming people that buy and sell used books. I'm like, there's a million reasons to do it, and it's better than ending up in the landfill. It's just personally, it's not a priority for me to start selling them. But yeah, I like things like that because I think physical objects matter. I think also books are like a good technology. Like, I remember that was a big subject of controversy when ebooks first came out. It's like, are books going to go away the way the physical media for records went away and CDs and all of that? And the thing about books is, like, you have the Library of Alexandria that was destroyed and we lost so much knowledge. And meanwhile, there's books that were around then 3,000, 2,000 years ago that are still readable. Like, that's really critical and amazing. So, like, first editions or antique books, like, I'm all for them. Are we going to start selling them? I mean, possibly. It would be like whether our bookstores, whether that was important to our bookstores and our customers, I guess. If we felt like we were losing a ton of customers to Amazon because we weren't selling them, that would be a motivation. If our bookstores were like, I really want to be able to sell these books on your site and I can't right now, that would be a motivation. In general, I like stuff like that. But there's going to be like a real, we've got such a long list of things that we want to do that we would have to have a good reason to start doing that. Mm. You know, and the book is a physical object. Like, we do have a lot of success with things like this one has painted edges and a special embossed cover and it's a special collector's edition. And generally bookstores do really well with that kind of stuff, or like signed editions and special editions. And so that's a big part of why somebody would switch from Amazon to a local bookstore is because they want to get something special.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite local bookstore that you go to in person?
I don't think I can say that. I can say my local bookstore is Word in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
But I can't say any bookstore is my favorite.
I suppose that'd be a little too political.
Yeah.
As well. I live in Ridgewood. So my local I go to is Topos, which is on Bookshop.
Yeah. Great.
But my childhood local, when I first started using Bookshop and I didn't live in this neighborhood, my childhood local in small town California, they're for some reason not on there, which I'm every time I go on and I try to set it to them, I'm always bummed because I try to buy a book there every time I go visit my family.
Yeah, well, just tell them to join. Like, the thing about joining, like, if they'll join, they'll just get $3,000. Like, even if they join and don't do any work and joining takes 20 minutes, they'll get $3,000. Just for joining.
Well,
I'm about to start a fake bookstore, Andy. Get my cut.
PPP scam, fake bookshop.
Yeah. I'm thinking about, like, as we're talking, like, should bookshops sell magazines?
My local back, they all the ones I know do. Or not, maybe Topos doesn't, but I go to Spoonbill in Sugartown in Williamsburg. They sell magazines.
Yeah, we've talked about it a lot. And we've met with some companies. Like, I'm for that. I used to work in magazines. Like, that's where my first media jobs were in magazines. So I would love to sell magazines. So yes, the answer is yes. Bookshops should sell magazines.
Well, let me know if you decide and give me the exclusive, because that's
okay.
I would be very excited in my world. What are you reading right now? Last question.
You know, I'm reading Barbarians at the Gate, which is this weird business book that my brother-in-law had. I mean, it's not weird. It's an amazing, gripping business book from about the leveraged takeover of RJR Nabisco. But it's like really interesting book about Wall Street and kind of when Wall Street started being openly greedy and like all about the money and excess. A huge shift from like the old kind of corporate responsibility days to the days of like raiders and profiteers. And it's a very interesting kind of social history of that time period through the story of RJ Reynolds and Nabisco's hostile takeover. And it's super good. I love it. And I'm also reading the new Don DeLillo, which I got from Penguin Random House, which I'm excited about. And I just finished Audition, which I'm sure everybody's reading, because it's probably going to be one of the top three books of the year, I'd say.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I'm still waiting for somebody to explain it to me, but
yeah, it's one of those books.
Maybe you and I could connect offline.
I'm like, I've got to read what people are saying about this online to understand it.
Well, I still think she was dead at the end of The Guest, so I might not be the best person to like offer my theories.
Daisy, what are you reading?
Empire of the Elite. I think. Maybe I should read Barbarians at the Gate. I needed to read something about the media business it just came out, so it's timely. But every once in a while, like, I also will read like a business book or something a lot more businessy, because that's like, I start to like notice things that should have been obvious to me that I should be doing that I'm not doing. just because like it's so easy to get into day-to-day mode, or you have a lot of discussions about your business, but you don't have a lot of discussions about business in general, other than like seeing threads on Twitter about best practices in business that are really just ways for people to brag about what they're doing. And so actually reading like about historical shifts in the business is so helpful, because most things just haven't changed and don't change about what it takes to build something lasting. It's just our conversations have gotten a lot more shallow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's super interesting for me. And with the caveat that there's tons of bad business books, like there's so many.
That's ones. True. But
I remember when I was in my early 20s, I started my first magazine, and my dad, who had been an entrepreneur, was like, okay, let's do a business plan and let's figure out how you're going to make money. And I'm like, Dad, this isn't a business. This is about creativity, period. Like, leave me alone. But now, like 25 years later, I'm like, sustainability is what keeps like this difference between something that exists for 2 years and like has a lasting impact on things. And so yeah, like, understanding, like, even if you have great creative aspirations and you're supporting all these creative people, like you are when you're doing a media business, like having a sense of business understanding is like really, really important. And a really good business book can give you that for sure.
Yeah. Have you read Never Split the Difference?
No.
I think it's like if I remember correctly, it's like negotiation tips from a former like hostage negotiator that worked for like the CIA or something.
Never split
classic the business.
I can't say it served me particularly well. I'm really not the best negotiator. I just get frustrated and walk away. I'm like, if you follow me down the street, you can follow me down the street, but I'm gone.
Yeah. I read a book called Bargaining for Advantage, which that was like the first business book I actually intentionally read, because I knew I had to negotiate and I wanted to read something about it. And I learned so much. The most important thing I learned is that people assume that you are like they are. So if there's somebody, if it's somebody that's going to cheat you or that wants to like have the biggest advantage, then they're going to assume that you're trying to do the same thing. If it's somebody that like wants a collaborative outcome, like we both end up better off at the end of the deal, they're going to think that you're the same way. Mm-hmm. They're like, and understanding that one thing that like people are going to think that you think the way they do, like it actually really is a great way to understand all kinds of human behavior and how people are treating you and whether they trust your motives and things like that. And that book was a business book that I benefited from. Bargaining for
Andy,
advantage.
You might have just helped me out with something there. On that note, guys, this has been Tasteland. Thank you so much.
This is Tasteland. Thank you. We'll see you next week.